Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday, folks. It's Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. And here we are. It's the middle of July already, 2017. I don't know where the time goes, let me tell you. It is, it's almost distressing. In any event, we have lots of stuff to go over this morning. And I am only going to mention this Trump-Russia thing, which I am absolutely, if I hear it one more time, if I hear some moron pundit discuss it, either on radio or TV or whatever, or I read one more non-factual, contrived, pull-it-out-of-your-butt article on it, I think I'm going to retch. So I don't know what you're thinking. But I have a feeling that most of my listeners, all of you out there in 50 states and a bunch of countries and all sorts of places, you have to be sick of it too. I mean, it's in the beginning, it was disconcerting. Then it kind of grew to worrisome. Then it kind of went to humorous. And now it's just plain frustrating nonsense. I mean, I want these people to govern this country. The one thing that all this nonsense proves is how desperately afraid the left is of Trump's agenda, because this has nothing to do with Russia or Trump. This has to do with stopping his agenda, stopping him dismantling basically what they put together over the last 40 years with very few exceptions. Anyway, I'm going to briefly talk about one little component of this Russia deal to use as an example of what false nonsense, what a false flag, red herring, silver quarter meant to distract this whole deal is. And I think you'll find it very, very, very interesting, and you'll find it surprising. And we're going to talk a little bit about the loony left. Since we're not going to be dwelling incessantly and obsessively on Russia. The Russians are coming. The Russians are coming. Run for the hills. Get in your bunker. The Russians. You know, I never knew the Russians were so damn smart and competent. It's really come as a surprise. In any event, we're going to be talking about stuff that nobody else is talking about because everybody's too busy breathing all the Russian nonsense oxygen in the room. And we're going to talk about the loony left. And some of these stories are kind of scary. And I'm going to use them to illustrate a point. But they will flat make your eyes bug out. I almost guarantee it. Then we're going to talk about, because none of the media is talking about this, Trump's voting commission. And it has a long name, and I'll find it here somewhere and give it to you. But the bottom line is, it's run by the former Secretary of State of Kansas, which has very strict voting laws. Or should I say, voting laws that comport with making sure that only legal votes are cast. And that commission, which is bipartisan, has asked 50 states, all 50 states, for all sorts of information about their voter rolls. I'm going to bring you up to date on what's going on with that because nobody's covering it. And you'll find, as is true with a lot of stuff that Trump does, right? He flushed out the moronic media mess, lefties, just fake news people. He flushed out the loony left. I mean, he's really good at flushing things out, getting them out of the closet. And, you know, the left has been jumping up and down for years about voter ID. Oh, my God, it's voter suppression. I mean, you know, you need an ID to go down and get your welfare stamp, I think. Your welfare stuff, your food stamps. You need an ID to check into a hotel, to buy a pack of cigarettes, to get booze, to, you know, you name it. You need an ID. But you don't need an ID to vote. And the left says, don't worry about it, though, because there's no voter fraud. Well, what I'm going to tell you this morning is going to be absolute concrete proof there's voter fraud, because before this commission even gets going, I mean, in just sending out the request letter for information, it has precipitated all sorts of stuff with illegal voters. You're going to laugh. And I'm going to use Colorado as an example. Right here in the Rocky Mountain West, you know, where there's no fraudulent votes. Okay. And then I got several emails, including several from overseas, one from Denmark, one from Norway, one from Germany, which is really interesting. Apparently, there's quite a few people overseas who listen to On the Right Side radio podcast, which I find great. I mean, very flattering. Very flattering. But they were very interested in that story I did last week over Germany passing this hate speech law. And you can, if you haven't listened to last week's show, you should tune in and listen to it. And I did a little more digging because the questions were pretty much the same, which is, what exactly is the law and what exactly are the penalties for espousing what the German government has now labeled as quote-unquote hate speech? Not objectively, but subjectively. In other words, they get to make the call. And, of course, you know where that leads, particularly when you have an opposing political view. So I dug up the law over there, and I'm going to give it to you in a nutshell. And actually, it's quite chilling. And if it's a foreshadow of what the left wants to do over here, we need to be on our guard. Then I have an article which is really going to interest all you parents. I know many of you are, or even grandparents. So, you know, I've been ranting and raving about the fact that Common Core sucks. There's no other way to term it. And that it was all a big ruse to kind of, shall we say, dumb down the population and build the compliant proletariat for the ever-growing government. Some of you are rolling your eyes right now going, oh man, this guy has a tinfoil hat. Well, I'm going to give you some information tonight which absolutely proves my point. This morning. It's actually early this morning. It's only 2 o'clock. I usually do this show at 3 o'clock on Saturday mornings. So this is like midday. In fact, I'm surprised not to see the sun shining out the studio window here. Anyway, you'll find it really fascinating, this Common Core story. And then I'm going to tell you a little bit about what's happening economically, which is tied in to a number of things. Number one, and I have talked about it incessantly, you can put it in the search bar, quantitative easing, Federal Reserve, United States dollar. You can listen to all those shows. I was jumping up and down about this stuff, you know, years ago. Now everybody else is starting to jump up and down. In a way, it's kind of humorous. I had no idea Wyoming was such a leader in economic thought. But there's a couple of lines converging in this economy. Number one, is Trump going to be able, how do I put this mildly, to overcome the resistance of the progressives and their phony Russia stories and all the other obstruction and the delay of 13 of his judicial nominees, and let me put it this way. Obama at this time, I'm rounding numbers, okay, I may be a few off, had like 380 top-level appointments by this time in his first term as president. Trump has like 150. Obama had X amount of judicial nominees. You can see by the court rulings that you're getting out of the Ninth and Fourth Circuit and out of this moron judge in Hawaii who, despite two rulings by the Supreme Court, is trying to tell the Supreme Court what their rulings mean. It's just unbelievable. And Obama's buddy to boot, appointed by Obama, in fact. But Trump does not have his team in place yet. And, of course, there's all sorts of other headwinds for Trump. This Russia nonsense and obstruction at every way, in every way, shape, and form, and at every turn. So whether or not Trump gets some key components of his agenda done, like taxes and Obamacare, and to a lesser extent, but still important, infrastructure, is going to have a direct bearing on the economy and jobs and et cetera. There's another trend in the economy which I think many of you sense but really isn't being talked about, and that is the death of retail. In other words, the death of brick and mortar stores out there. Whether they're bookstores, Hastings, 136 unit chain, who sold thousands of my books. Great little stores. They were located in smaller towns, you know, Gillette, Wyoming, Grand Junction, Colorado, Montrose, Colorado, Moscow, Idaho, Laramie, Wyoming. You know, those kinds of places. Not big enough to support a Barnes & Noble, let's say, but certainly big enough for a store like Hastings, which had a terrific book selection, and lots of games and videos and kind of, you know, weekend stuff for the family. And I did a lot of book signings, always did really, really, really well. Logan, Utah, Ogden, Utah. I mean, Hastings all around. And that chain closed about 6, 7, 8 months ago, which I personally found very distressing, and a lot of people in these smaller towns who relied on them to be their larger than normal, but basically the local bookstore, the local entertainment center, found distressing too. But this is true of retail in many sectors. In fact, the numbers are mind-boggling. They are, seriously, you will gasp when I tell you what's happening in the retail sector, including major brands, major names that you know, what's happening with these stores, how many closings, how many bankruptcies, you name it, and the reasons for this, which I'm going to get into. And that all coincides with what's happening in the financial markets, where the central banks, the Federal Reserve, the Central European Bank, the Bank of England, all the central banks are now, I don't think they've quite realized how much damage they've done over the last 8 years, thank you Obama and the rest of the globalists, by printing money, buying their own bonds, inflating their balance sheets, creating all sorts of world debt. But, you know, the Piper has, as Jeremiah Wright would say, while Barry and Mushel were listening to him, the chickens are about to come home to roost. And so these banks are trying to pull back from this quantitative easing, this printing of money out of thin air to keep interest rates basically at zero. Negative in some cases around the world. In fact, I've done shows on this. Type in negative interest rates. I'm sure 3 or 4 shows will come up over the last several years. And as they back out, there's going to be less liquidity, less cash in the system. And interest rates are going to rise. And, you know, obviously, folks who are in the markets and in business and all this stuff know this. And I'm sure you know this, too, if you've been out shopping for a car loan, a house loan, any of that stuff. So we're going to talk about how those three things, Trump's agenda, what's happening in the retail, the bloodbath, that's the only way you can describe it, in brick-and-mortar retail, and what the central banks are doing, how that could possibly, and probably will, have a really noticeable effect on you and your family. And there's some things you can do about it if you kind of move smartly, and not with haste, but should we say, don't dedaddle. So that is going to be our show this morning. And of course, I'm going to start the show off with a story. It's Reed's Story Time on the Right Side Radio. This has really become quite a popular segment. I mean, people, the one or two times since I started this a couple months ago, the one or two times I haven't told a story at the beginning of the show, I have gotten all sorts of hate email. I mean, people are like, oh, I'll come up and pitchfork you. Anyway, the story I'm going to tell you today is of Mad Max at the Ranch. Yeah, Mad Max at the Ranch. So, anyway, it is hay season out here in the mountains of Wyoming. And it's a crazy season. And, you know, when we run cows, we run yearlings, so we can sell hay. And we long ago kind of developed specialized horse hay. And it has all sorts of goodies in it. We have like four or five different types. And we've become pretty well known for it, with a lot of repeat customers. Some as far away as New Mexico and Arizona. I mean, it's pretty flattering. But we have two different types of grass hay. One with kind of a orchard wild alfalfa base in a mix of six grasses, and then one with a crested wheat base in a mix of five other grasses. And then we have grass alfalfa mix, and then we have alfalfa and all sorts of stuff. Anyway, the hay stuff has been crazy. In the last few years, we've been significantly sold out before we even start cutting. So there is this very nice couple. I'm going to not even give their location. Shall we say within a few hundred miles of the ranch. And they call me, a month or so ago. And they wanted somewhere between 50 and 60 bales. We put up these big 3-foot by 3-foot by 8-foot bales. Oh, the weights vary depending upon the baler and the moisture content and all that stuff. But let's call them 900 pounds, give or take, each. I mean, they're significant bundles of hay. And they wanted 50 or 60 bales, and they have horses and other stuff. And they happen to be in an area of the West which has experienced over the last several years pretty significant drought conditions. So we have a lot of buyers from that area, in fact. Anyway, we get everything all set. We get the hay cut. We get it all baled. And the way we're set up, there's a big creek that runs through the center of what we call the home ranch, where we do all the hay and the ranch house is located, etc. And to load a semi-truck, which can carry somewhere between 52 and 72 of these big square bales, depending upon how the truck's set up, to load a semi-truck, we have to take them across this little narrow bridge about 10 feet over the water. It's interesting, and I've had I'll tell you some stories about the bridge sometime, too. But in any event, we have to take it across the bridge, and then we have to put it in the stack yard, because that's the only place that we can get a semi in where they can load, and then they can do a loop around the barn, not have to back up, and everybody's happy. So, over the years, obviously, we have loaded countless semis. And we also have a clientele, by the way, who come in and they buy one or two bales, or they buy 10, or they buy 30, and they come in with their own trailers, you know, car trailer, which you've seen, which are those smaller trailers, or once in a while we get somebody who says, just throw a bale on the back of the pickup, which I never like to do. And then we have people who, you know, pretty experienced, they got five or six horses, they know what they're doing, they come in with a gooseneck 24, 28, 30-foot trailer, and they can haul 18 of these things on their own. Anyway, it's quite interesting, and almost without exception, everybody is terrific. I mean, every once in a while, as you would expect, you run into a yahoo, to whom we will not sell in the future, and who knows, probably they wouldn't want to buy in the future. And the truckers who drive these semis, I mean, most of these guys are doing it for a living. They don't just have a semi parked outside the house to haul hay twice a year, are terrific. I mean, they're really great guys. It's very enjoyable working with them. They participate in the loading process because somebody has to be directing. You know, when you're putting up these big old square bales, and our reach lift, which is what we move the bales with these big spears that spear the bales and lift them up in the air. When they're going up and you're stacking bales, let's say four high, that's 12 feet high, on the deck, the trailer deck of a semi, which is sitting about 5 or 6 feet off the ground, I mean, you're way up there. And when you're sitting down in that reach lift, you can't see really what's going on, particularly if it's the far stack. Normally, you stack these semis three bales across, four bales high, three or four bales high. And so you can kind of imagine that somebody has to be directing you so that you know you're centered as you're stacking the bales. Otherwise, you have a big wreck, and you have a lousy load, and you have to redo it, and then you can't strap it, and stuff falls off, and it's really a bad day. And the State Patrol hates you. Or hates the poor trucker. Anyway, so 2 days ago, it came time to get this delightful couple. They were really terrific on the phone and email, etc. And sent us a nice deposit. So I was looking forward to loading their hay for them. I had actually picked out some really nice bales. I had it all staged in the stack yard and ready to go. And when we know we have a semi coming in, rather than stacking our bales four high, which is how you stack them to best protect them from weather if they're going to be sitting there for a month or two, when I know we have a truck coming in literally in days, I stack them just two high because it makes the loading and the unloading and the stacking and the handling way easier, way faster. So I had these really great bales picked out for them. And we're all ready to load this semi, and we had already had several semis in, and a bunch of people with these bigger personal trailers, and there was probably, I don't know, 200 or 300 bales that had left the ranch already, and this was the last, literally, the last load of hay of our, what we call our initial cutting. We have 16 fields on the ranch with these various types of hay and alfalfa, etc., and we generally cut several of those fields, the front fields and what we call the canyon field, and the first cutting under the pivot, and that's our initial cutting. And then in our second cutting, our secondary cutting, we cut another 11 grass fields. And then in our last cutting, we do the second cutting under the pivot, which is grass and grass alfalfa and alfalfa. So, these people call me with the name of their trucker, whom I shall not divulge. And I thought the name was a little weird, but I kept my mouth shut. And I call him up, and he was nice enough on the phone. Everything was great. And we got lined up to do it actually today, Saturday. And I told him I would call him quite distinctly on the 12th. To line up the specific time and logistics for today. In fact, that's what I had planned to do when I was done with the radio show, had my coffee, got a couple hours sleep, etc. Make a long story short, we talk on the phone on, what was it, Tuesday night, the 11th. And he said, well, you know, I didn't know what we were doing on Saturday. I need to do it tomorrow because I got other loads scheduled. Unfortunately, I wasn't doing anything because he wanted to do it at 6 in the morning, and I figured it would take about an hour and a half, plus or minus to load the 50 to 60 bales. I had never seen how his truck was laid out, so I didn't know how many we could get on there. And that was without rushing it and, you know, doing a good job, etc. So, I say okay. I let the people know, and of course they were expecting to get their hay today, not 3 days ago. So they had to scramble around and kind of get all set at their end to be able to unload it when he arrived with it. And it is now Wednesday morning. It's 6 a.m. And I jump on the ATV and I race on down to the barnyard and I jump in the reach lift and I trundle up the road. I mean, the machine is a moose. And I park by there was 10 really nice wild grass and alfalfa bales. They were buying grass alfalfa that I had saved for them that I was going to load first, and then we'd go down the stackyard and load the rest. And I had told the trucker this. My ranch hand did not know I had told the trucker this, and the trucker has to go by his place to get further back in the ranch. And my ranch hand, who's a crusty old salt, he had his truck parked about halfway out his little driveway into the ranch road. Obviously, to stop the trucker. I could see all this as I was driving up the road. Obviously, to stop the trucker so you go out and direct him to the 10 bales. So he meant well. And any sane person would have stopped when they saw that truck because there was no way around it. In comes the semi. As I'm driving up the road, the semi is coming toward me from under the arch about, oh, I don't know, half mile out. And I was incredulous. Instead of slowing down or stopping because there's a pickup parked across the ranch road, and my ranch hand was now walking from his place toward the pickup. I mean, this is within 100 feet of the trucker. There's no way he couldn't have seen it. He doesn't slow down a bit. He swerves the semi around the pickup. And, you know, most roads that you want to keep nice have a drainage ditch that runs along the road to catch all the water. So it doesn't go on the road, and then it goes down the drainage ditch to a culvert and goes under the road, and everybody's happy, including the road. And when you're sitting 12 feet high, or whatever it is, in a semi, you can see these kind of things. They're not small. I mean, they're pretty big. He swerves around the pickup and promptly drives into the drainage ditch. And here's his semi stuck as a bug in a rug with its front bumper resting on the dirt and its right front wheel sunk about a foot and a half in this drainage ditch. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, what's going on here? This is not an auspicious beginning to the day. And I had been in a good mood. My mood was quickly dissipating, like with the wind that was whistling across the hayfield and into the canyons. Anyway, I walk up there, and he has this scowl on his face. And I don't want to tell you exactly what he said, but it was something that rhymes with hit when he talked about how his day was going. And I tried to make light of it. I said, well, listen, we're right on time. It's like 6:01, and I'll pull you out of there with a reach lift, lickety-split. And he looks at me, he goes, well, I want you to use the front end of that reach lift and lift it out and pull it over. I looked at him and said, what? The reach lift has a 6,000-pound lift capacity, and I guarantee you your semi weighs more than 6,000 pounds. So, number one, I won't get you unstuck. Number two, I'll hurt our machine. I mean, this is a big beast of a machine. How about I back it up to the front of your truck? We attach a chain, and I bet it pulls it out like a hot knife through butter, which is what we did, and it did. It was about 2 seconds, and the truck was out of the ditch. And then he turns to my crusty old salt of a ranch hand, and he goes, well, what was that ditch doing there anyway? And my guy looks at him and goes, well, you know, that's to keep the water off the road. He goes, well, I mean, I couldn't see it. I drove right in it. And my crusty old ranch hand looks at him, and I cracked up and said, well, you know, if you come to a bridge and the bridge is out, that doesn't mean you have to drive across it. I loved it. Anyway, the guy turns scarlet. He drives down to the 10 bales, and I'm gonna shorten this story up, otherwise I'm gonna use up the whole show. But it was an amazing morning. He drives down to the 10 bales. I load 9 of them on. He had this weird configuration on his truck. He had side rails on it, and he had an upper deck and a lower deck, and I've never loaded one quite like it, to be honest with you. But I load 9 bales on the upper deck, 3 of these grass alfalfa bales, 3 high, 3 across. And then he says, you see that space on that upper deck behind those? I said, yeah. He goes, I want you to load the next 3 bales crosswise. And I looked at him and said, and you want me to do that how? The reach lift, which can reach about 3 times longer than a tractor, has a 36-foot reach, and your lower deck is 42 feet long, so I can't load it over the back. I don't think you want me to drive out over your nice shiny rig here and lift a bale over the cab and then just drop it in there to see what happens. He goes, oh, well, you can spear it through the narrow end. I looked down and said, what? A 3-foot spear through an 8-foot bale means when I lift it, the bale's going to break, period. So I'm not going to lift it. And he started to say something, and, you know, I guess I have a fairly short fuse under some conditions, and I guess that fuse kind of got lit, and I just kind of looked at him and said, you know, I don't do attitude. So he kind of kept his mouth shut. The 9 bales were loaded. I put the rest on the back to be moved later. And then we drove down to the barnyard. And with the way we have this set up is there's a kind of a pull-out space for the semis. So I have enough room to work with the loading machine. And then the semis, they can either do it up front or they can do it after they're loaded. Just drives a little way down and they can circle the barn. Never have to back up. It's nice and easy for the trucks. And they love it. And then drive their way out. He said, well, I'm going to go down and turn around before you load. And I said, that's fine. Anyway, I hear kind of a little bang down there. I didn't really think about it, but I do remember hearing it. He gets back up there and gets a semi position, and he looks at me, once again, a scowl on his face. He goes, I ruined my toolbox. I said, you did what? He goes, yeah, I ruined my toolbox because that railroad tire, blah, blah, thing that you have, it's an $1,100 toolbox. Well, first of all, I looked at the toolbox, and, you know, if you looked at it just right with the right light angle, you could see, like, a little wrinkle in it. And he had just opened both doors, which seemed to open fine to get out straps, so I wasn't going to argue with him, but it didn't look ruined to me. And, you know, the only thing I said to him was, you know, there's been a whole lot of trucks that go around that barn, and nobody's ever ruined a toolbox before. Anyway, it went downhill from there, folks. It went downhill from there. And at the at the very end, I'm skipping over a lot of good stuff here. But at the very end, he said, I'd like you to straighten up the load for me, which is pretty standard, before you do the final strapping and kind of get them tight. I said, well, let's drive out to the front gate. You know, it's only a couple minutes from the barnyard, where I got level ground on both sides of the truck, and it'll be a lot easier. He agreed. So we go out there, and we're right before he's going to drive out the entry arch. And as I'm working, he's telling me how, I think he said something like, you're really slow. And, you know, I looked at him. I'm trying to move hay and focus on that. And I'm getting more and more and more pissed off. And I kept my mouth shut. He goes, you haven't loaded much hay before, have you? You know, and I kind of gave him a dirty look. Kept my mouth shut. And his back stack was 3 bales across and 4 bales high. Now remember, he had been sitting there supposedly helping me load, i.e. directing me, which he had not done, which is the reason we had to straighten up the load to begin with. He had watched me load this whole truck. He said, you know, I really don't like 4 bale high on that back stack. Just doesn't ride well. And I looked at him, and I finally kind of cracked. And I went, well, why the hell didn't you say something when I was loading it? I mean, you were standing right there. If you didn't want a 4 high, I could have done a 3 high or 2 high or whatever you wanted. I'll tell you what, how about I take the top 3 bales off right now and it'll be 3 high? Oh, no, no. I promised these folks that they'd have 60 bales, and I keep my promises. And, you know, I looked at him, I said, well, if you got five rows of 12 bales and then you got the 9 bales up front, by my count, that's 69. So I think you got the latitude to take those 3 bales off, which I'm happy to do for you. No. Anyway, we get it all settled up. He drives out the deal. And as he's driving out the arch, you're turning onto the state highway there. You know, it's a little two-lane paved road. No great shakes. It ain't the interstate. And again, he made his turn too shallow, which is exactly what he did when he went around the barn and quote-unquote wrecked his $1,100 toolbox. And he runs over here, as I'm going to have to go pull it out today, in fact. He runs over the reflector the state puts up at all driveway entrances, which is now bent like perpendicular to the ground. So, the moral of this story, the moral of this story is I met the 1 in a million trucker from hell, Mad Max of the ranch. And you know, sometimes in life you know from the very first second that it just ain't going to work. Or at the best, it's not going to work very well. And I kind of knew that when he drove in that ditch in the very first 5 seconds of being on the ranch. And then got out without us. I mean, he could have been at least laughing a little bit at his own stupidity. When he got out of that truck with a scowl. So the moral of the story is, when stuff starts like that, it's better to end it right then. Because I was half tempted, when he was telling me how to use a reach lift to lift the truck that he had driven into the ditch, I was half tempted to say, you know, your folks are going to have to get another trucker because I'm not going to load you. And the moral of this story is, that's exactly what I should have done. And you can apply this story to lots of things in life, can't you? You can apply it to lots of dealings of and between nations, in fact. You can apply it to dealings between people who are under the same flag in nations. Which brings us to, yes, the one little thing I'm going to tell you about Russia Trump, gag me on this story, before we move on to much more relevant things that nobody's telling you. Number one, we know that Comey leaked. Number two, we know that Trump had a really great speech in Poland last week. And number three, we know that the day after the great speech in Poland, lo and behold, there's leaks coming from somewhere mysterious in the deep state, to the New York Times about Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with some attorney, blah, 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 blah. You've heard, it's impossible that you haven't heard something about it. So I'm not going to go there. But I will point out that since we know Comey leaks stuff, and since we know, and I've talked about it before, that the corporate culture of an agency, an entity, a business, a country is set by the guy at the top. And we know that that story about Donald Jr.'s meeting, which was rather foolish, was leaked the day after Trump's Great Poland speech. I think that most of these leaks are coming from the FBI itself. That's not to say some of Clapper and Obama's holdovers at the DNI and the NSA, and some of the folks that Brennan put in place at the CIA aren't contributing, but I'm pretty sure now. I've been speculating about this, and I've talked about it on shows, but these leaks are coming from the FBI, folks. I don't know who in the FBI, but it's coming from the FBI. Because the other thing that was going on at the time that Trump did his Great Poland speech was a whole bunch of chatter about Comey being in legal trouble for revealing classified information when he did his leaks, his admitted leaks. I mean, he admitted the leaks under oath to Congress. So what better way to get the focus off a great speech by Trump and your old friend, ally, and boss, Mr. Comey, getting shellacked in the press than to create a new story, a new red herring? Kind of interesting to think about, isn't it? And, you know, next week I'm going to talk a little bit about Fusion GPS and some of the cast of dark characters in this. Once again, stuff that you pretty much have not heard because it's really a tangled web. But I want to pick one thing to demonstrate what BS the media is spewing. What BS the progressives, i.e. Democrats, are spewing. And how bogus this whole hoax is. How many times have you heard, and I know you've heard it, that all 17 intelligence agencies signed off on the report that Russia meddled with the election? Or if you're a Democrat, hacked the election. You've heard it 100 times. Maybe you've heard it 500 times. All 17 intelligence agencies agree on this. Well, I hate to tell you, folks, but all 17 intelligence agencies did not agree on it. This is made up crapola. And James Clapper himself said all 17 agencies never saw it or signed off on it. And the AP and the New York Times just in the last week had to withdraw their stories that said 17 agencies and redo them. Because in the end, there were only three agencies that came up with this conclusion, even though they couldn't get access to the evidence like the DNC server to substantiate their hypothesis. Three agencies. The FBI, gee, what a coincidence. The CIA, run by Mr. Brennan, no coincidence, and the NSA. The 17 agencies is a myth. I mean, it's as big a myth as Hansel and Gretel. It is ridiculous. And by the way, you can look up New York Times and AP retracting this story and take a look at it for yourself. I'm going to put the kibosh on this 17 agency myth. And I think you will agree it is a glaring example of how bogus this entire story is, just delving into this one little aspect of it that's been repeated 100 times by news media, pundits, fake news outfits. I mean, just unbelievable. So this is under oath before Congress. James Clapper. Additionally, this is a quote. Additionally, I'll briefly address four related topics that have emerged since the ICA, that was the report about Russian meddling, was produced. Because of both classification and some executive privilege strictures requested by the White House, there are limits to what I can discuss. Obviously, there were no limits to what Comey could discuss relative to executive privilege in his meetings with Trump. That's my little add-in there. And, of course, my direct official knowledge of any of this stopped on 20 January, when my term of office was happily over. As you know, the ICA was a coordinated product from three agencies, CIA, NSA, and the FBI. Not all 17 components of the intelligence community. Those three are under the aegis of my former office. In other words, they all answered to him. Following an extensive intelligence reporting about many Russian efforts to collect on and influence the outcome of the presidential election, President Obama asked us to do this in early December and have it completed by the end of his term. The 24 or so analysts for this task were hand-picked seasoned experts from each of the three contributing agencies. They were given complete, unfettered, mutual access to all sensitive raw intelligence data, and importantly, complete independence to reach their findings. They found that the Russian government pursued a multifaceted influence campaign in the run-up to the election, blah, 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 blah. Now, he makes it pretty clear that there's only three agencies and not 17 because the myth had been circulating prior to this testimony. Senator Al Franken, the progressive Democrat moron creep from Minnesota, who won his seat fraudulently through voter fraud, which of course he and the other progressives say don't exist. You can listen to my show on this if you want. Just type in Franken, Senator. Doesn't let it go. He says, and I quote, "I want to thank both you and the ranking member for this hearing and these hearings. And I want to thank General Clapper," that's Jim Clapper, the guy I just quoted, "and Attorney General Yates," oh yes, remember the gal that wouldn't execute Trump's deal, "and Attorney General Yates for appearing today. We have, the intelligence communities have concluded, all 17 of them, that Russia interfered with this election, and we all know how that's right." And then James Clapper interjects. I quote, "Senator, as I pointed out in my statement, Senator Franken, there were only three agencies that were directly involved in this assessment, plus my office." Franken, quote, "But all 17 signed on to that." Clapper, quote, "Well, we didn't go through that. That process, this was a special situation because of the time limits and what I knew to be who could really contribute to and the sensitivity of the situation, we decided it was a constant judgment to restrict it to those three. I rest my case." And you liberals out there who listen to me and have been running around at your tea parties or whatever you do, your safe rooms, doing your herbal essence or whatever you do, who have been talking amongst yourselves about how all 17 agencies, you'll have to revise your story. It's just three. The other 14 were never consulted or saw the report. Which brings us to, since we were talking about Al Franken, voter fraud. Because without voter fraud, Al Franken wouldn't have won his Senate seat by 316 votes because there were 1,800 felons in Minnesota who voted for him who did not have the right to vote. But there is no voter fraud in the United States. We'll get to that here in the segment upcoming. So Trump has this commission. If you listen to my show last week, I talked about a new report saying about 5.7 million illegal aliens, even more than the 5 million I supposed, illegal aliens cast votes over the last several elections. And I have done a number of shows just type in voter fraud. I've done a number of shows about how much voter fraud there really is in the United States, and it's millions of votes, folks. It's dead people voting and dogs voting and people voting more than one time and people voting under a different name and people who supposedly live somewhere, but when you go there, there's a vacant lot voting and illegal aliens voting and felons who don't have the right to vote voting and on and on and on. Along with fake registrations and dummy voters and, you know, paying for look, it's rampant. And the right isn't entirely free of blame, but 95% of it is all on the left. So Trump has established this commission. It's bipartisan. They sent out this letter saying, basically, we want the Social Security numbers, the addresses, the voter registration identification, and the party of affiliation of every voter you have on the voter rolls. They sent that to all 50 states. Obviously, the Democratic states are saying they will not cooperate. New York, California, Illinois, Connecticut, they will not cooperate. 30 states will cooperate as fully as they can. And then there's another 10 or so states that will cooperate partially, including, amazingly, Texas, because the state constitution precludes them from giving some of the information the federal government is asking for. Otherwise, Texas would comply completely. However, the more important thing is that all that stuff will get sorted out, as they say. I'm going to take just Colorado. Just Colorado. One state, and just three voting districts, Arapahoe County, Denver County, and Boulder County. So, Trump sends out the letter. Colorado remarkably says they will comply. And within 5 days, this is within the last week to 10 days, folks, within 5 days, just in these three counties, hundreds of people have canceled their voter registrations. The penalty, by the way, for voter fraud, for casting an illegal vote, is 3 years in jail and $10,000 fine. Of course, you can't be illegally registered to vote if you're not registered to vote. So I'll leave it to your imagination why hundreds of people in each of these three counties, immediately upon learning Colorado would comply with turning over this cross-check information, have suddenly rescinded their voter registration. The average, by the way, for all three counties put together at this time, that is 9 months, whatever it is, after an election, would be 10 requests. Instead, there are hundreds per county. Pretty amazing. And by the way, the actual name is called withdrawn registrations. In Denver alone, and this is as of a week ago, I'm sure there's more, 180 folks withdrew their registrations. The city of Aurora, 160 people withdrew their applications. It's like 300 or 400 in Boulder. Anyway, so I don't want to hear from anybody again how there is no voter fraud, because that's as bad as saying 17 agencies were involved in the Russian report. There is voter fraud. Until we do this study by this bipartisan commission and cross-check all the registration rules, we don't know where it's focused, and we don't know the aggregate total of all the illegal votes that have been cast. But there is voter fraud. And let me tell you that a couple hundred votes, a couple thousand votes, in a hotly contested race, can make the difference. Al Franken won his Senate seat by 300 votes. That's the equivalent of just two of these counties in Colorado with withdrawn registrations. The incumbent Republican governor of North Carolina lost his seat to the Democratic challenger in November, November of 16, by, I think it was 1,600 votes, or 1,400. I mean, it's very close. And we all know situations. Trump lost electoral votes in the main, I think it's Maine 4th District, is that right, producer? Yeah, I think it's the 4th District of Maine. It was like by 25 votes. I mean, it was like less than 100 votes. He lost an electoral vote in the Electoral College. So every vote matters. Every vote counts. And we really need to get the voting and the voting fraud situation under control in this country once and for all. Or we can send all the fraudulent voters to California because we know how they're going to vote, and you can just write them off from day one, and they can load the rolls with like 50 million fraudulent voters, and it doesn't matter. How's that? Now, since I got all these emails from overseas, very interested in this German deal, and the title of the story last week, if you want to put it in the search bar, was "The Gestapo comes to Germany," or "The German Gestapo," something like that. Basically, Germany has raided 36 people, just as a quick recap, 36 people's homes because of what Germany has determined is quote-unquote hate speech on their social media pages. And the hate speech seems to be anything that doesn't agree with Angela Merkel's government, her concept of Muslim immigration, and who knows what else. A very, very dangerous situation. You never want to give the government the right to determine what you can and can't say or what constitutes X, Y, or Z speech. Because before you know it, they will be using it to make sure you don't criticize them. Which is how Nazi Germany got born to begin with, I might add. This is the law, for those of you overseas who asked to hear it, and I'm summarizing. Number one, whoever in a manner that is capable of disturbing the public peace, number one, incites hatred against segments of the population, or calls for violent or arbitrary measures against them, or, number two, assaults the human dignity of others by insulting, maliciously maligning, or defaming segments of the population, shall be punished with imprisonment from 3 months to 5 years. Second paragraph. Whoever, number one, with respect to writings, section 2, subsection 3, which incite hatred against segments of the population or a national, racial, or religious group, or one characterized by its folk customs, which call for violent or arbitrary measures against them, or which assault the human dignity of others by insulting, maliciously maligning, or defaming segments of the population or a previously indicated group, A, disseminates them, B, publicly displays, posts, presents, or otherwise makes them accessible, C, offers, gives, or makes accessible to a person under 18 years, or D, produces, obtains, supplies, stocks, offers, announces, commends, undertakes to import or export them, in order to use them or copies obtained from them within the meaning of numbers A through C, or facilitates such use by another, or, two, disseminates a presentation of the content indicated in number one by radio, shall be punished with imprisonment for not more than 3 years or a fine. In addition, the law goes on, and I'm not going to read that part of it for you. Facebook, Google, Twitter are all subject to this new German shut your trap if we don't like what you're saying law, which is exactly what it is. Facebook could be fined over $50 million. The same with Twitter. The same with Google. For each time they fail to remove hate speech, what I just defined, within 24 hours. That, folks, is what's going on in Germany. That, folks, is what the progressive left would love to see go on in the United States. Make no mistake about it, because Merkel is a lefty and a globalist, amongst other things. And exactly how dangerous this is, I don't have to describe for you. I mean, what I read to you in the definition of hate speech, there was nothing concrete in there at all. I mean, anybody could say that my radio broadcast right now is hate speech against the progressives. They could say other podcasts of mine talking about radical Islamic extremists is hate speech against them. They could say that my rants about Barack Hussein Obama, unfortunately our president for the last 8 years, was hate speech. This is not a place we want to go. This is a place that Germany has gone, and it's a scary place. By the way, the definition of right-wing extremist, according to this article, is anyone who questions the immigration policies of the Europe or thinks differently than the general population. Okay, very good. Very good. Now, for all you families out there with kids that are going to school, or that have gone to school, or that are going to go to school, parents and grandparents, and I think you'll see this article posted under the women section. So, we have long talked about the fact that Common Core was instituted by the government to make uniform the teaching and thinking practices of an entire generation. It really, Common Core, folks, is really mind control at the initial stage of mind development. It really is. There's this school, it's a charter school. It's called Mason Classical Academy, MCA, down in Florida, that said, you know, we don't like Common Core, and we're not going to follow its edicts. And Common Core, by the way, is in the process of being dismantled by the Trump administration and Betsy DeVos. One of the things which is driving progressives crazy, because in the end, they know they're going to win if they control a kid's mind, if they control a generation of children's mind. All you have to do is look at what's happening on all the universities around the country to know that they are correct. Their infiltration of the institutions of education has been brilliant and successful. And Common Core was the document which, of course, the government and the progressives told us was to better education and to help our children and to have let them achieve higher standards and a greater quality of life and blah, 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 blah. I mean, make me puke. Nothing to do with it. It's to make them into robots. Let me explain further. So Common Core, as I think all of you know, is federally mandated. It's a nationally standardized education program. more and more people despise Common Core. Thank God it's being taken apart by Trump. It imposes rigorous testing on students. It forces the curriculums, therefore, to be molded around these exams. And not at all around just learning development or critical thinking, which is what education is supposed to be about. Common Core, in the development of Common Core, there were a number of corporations that worked with the government, the true definition of fascism, as I explained to you last week. And experts pretty much agree that the Common Core approach to education is really preparing children for the life of being an employee, not a change maker or entrepreneur. Do you see how nasty this is? Not only are the corporations benefiting because they're training a bunch of employee robots for the future, but the government is benefiting because if you're not teaching people to think for themselves, to be change artists, to be entrepreneurs, which is highly independent people, then they will, of course, be the drones that applaud, listen to, and dutifully obey an ever-increasing government. That is the real purpose of Common Core. Do not kid yourself. So, MCA, Mason Classical Academy, they're located in Naples, Florida. They won a bunch of awards and a bunch of different grades in English language arts after the school, and in 1 year, after the school ditched Common Core. Now, some of you lefties out there who listen to me are going to go, oh, that's just a coincidence, blah, 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 so and so forth. The curriculum that MCA introduced, rather than the Common Core robot training, emphasized things like character traits, respect, integrity, citizenship, responsibility, classical literature, history, fine arts, which, by the way, are none of those are standards that are mandated in Common Core, quite the contrary. And very importantly, MCA switched back to teaching reading and writing skills via phonics, P-H-O-N-I-C-K-S, phonics, which is the way many of us learned, other than those of you who are probably under 30. So Common Core teaches kids to read through the memorization of whole words before they learn to read vowels, consonants, sounds, and recognize syllables. In other words, it teaches them to think like a computer rather than a human, and to read like a computer rather than a human. Common Core abandons phonics-based learning. MCA abandoned Common Core and returned to phonics-based reading and writing learnings. Within 1 year of that switch, 1 year, students at MCA were the top across all of Florida. Third graders at MCA were in the top 2% of the state. Fifth graders were in the top 1% of the state. And MCA was like number 3 in the country. And that's against some pretty tough private schools. Number 3 in the country for reading and writing, literature, absorption, understanding, you name it. 90% of the third grade students at Mason were proficient in English language arts compared to 58% of third graders in the country overall. So, look, You can look no further than MCA, Mason Academy, to know that Common Core sucks. It needs to go away. And it needs to be replaced by an old-fashioned, quote-unquote, education system that teaches these values, independence, critical thinking, thinking for yourself, and historical basis upon which to reason, think, and logically deduce for students, beginning with the very young. And Common Core needs to be gone just as quick as we can get it gone, because unfortunately Common Core has trained a whole generation who you now see in college breaking windows, burning cars, and jostling police, not to mention infringing like Andrea Merkel on the free speech of others. It's all part of a plan, folks. Which brings us to the economy. Because, you know, an economy thrives when it is inhabited by and driven by independent and successful people who want to create things. That's why small business generates 60%+ of all employment in the United States. Those are the critical free thinkers, the entrepreneurs, the people that Common Core wishes to destroy. Or should we say, make extinct. What's happening in the retail sector of our country, very few people other than a few business magazines here and there are talking about. Now, I'm sure all of you have been you've gone shopping, you've seen stores close, you may be downtown in a small town with shuttered stores along Main Street, you may notice the empty spaces in malls when you go in, growing, you know, ever more so over the past few years, and you may have had this feeling that something's going on. Well, it's going on all right. It's going on all right. Let's take one company, Abercrombie and Fitch. You know, it just so happens I bought my very first fly rod there, believe it or not, mail order, a long time ago. I can still see it. It was kind of a light brown with green ferrule wrappings. It was pretty cool. It was a lousy rod, but it was pretty cool. And I was pretty excited. I think it was, I don't know, 8 years old, 9 years old. Anyway, Abercrombie and Fitch's stock has plunged like 90% just in the past few years. It's now at $9.51. It has not been that low since the summer of 2000. That was in the middle of the dot-com bust, by the way. Abercrombie and Fitch, folks, is just one of the canaries in the coal mine, and there's a bunch of canaries. All of brick-and-mortar retail, they're struggling. They have overcapacity. They have too much goods, too many goods, too much merchandise, too much floor space, too many locations, you name it. And they are getting their butts kicked by online retailers such as Amazon and others. And, you know, we're all part of this, right? Think about how many things you've bought online, probably at an increasing rate over the last 3 years, rather than driving down to a store and buying it. Listen to these numbers. They're you will be flabbergasted. U.S. retailers, I'm quoting, U.S. retailers closed roughly 5,300 stores through June 30th, 2017. That is three times as many as during the same period last year. And by the way, this is a study by Fung Global Retail and Technology, a very well-respected firm in this field. The previous record of 6,163 store closings in 1 year, remember, you're 5,300 halfway through the year, was set during the financial crisis of 2008. Does that give you an idea? Let me, and I bet you ladies who listen to me have noticed this. All the big department stores, Macy's in trouble, I've talked about them before, JCPenney, Kmart, you name it. Sears, I mean, those, they're closing 150 stores between Kmart and Sears. To try and get business in the door, these big department stores are beginning to discount something that they have never, ever, ever discounted before, and that is high-end cosmetics. I know you ladies have noticed this. It's all part of this trend. Let me give you an example. Lord & Taylor, this is just last month, offered 15% off all cosmetics and fragrances. Bloomingdale's gave members of its loyalty program, you know, if you belong to the store and you pay your 25% membership, blah, 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 a $25 reward card for every $100 of cosmetics purchased. In other words, 25% discount. Macy's gave 15% off cosmetics and spent a whole bunch of money advertising it on national TV, I might add. So you probably have not seen until the last 6 to 18 months ever your favorite beauty stuff, you know, Estee Lauder, Bobbi Brown mascara, Shiseido blush, all that stuff that you guys like. I use it myself. Oh. I like the rouge, you know. The fluorescent pink stuff. Anyway, I digress. I bet you ladies have not seen discounts ever until the last 6 to 18 months. This is what's going on. These brick-and-mortar places are trying to lure you in to sell you stuff so you don't buy it online. And even even with that, even in cosmetics, this will tell you how dire, and I mean it's dire, the situation is. With all these promotions and ads and all this stuff, the sales of prestige makeup, right, all these famous brands that you ladies love, has grown, I mean, like by crazy. It was up $8 billion, an 11% increase over the same period a year early. That's amazing. However, the department stores, like I was just mentioning, the brick and mortar stores, their share of the cosmetic market fell 19%. This is throughout North America. Now, and actually I misspoke. Their market share fell from 19% to 19% from 23%, which is actually a 25%, give or take, fall in market share. This is despite all their ads, their discounts, and everything else. That'll give you an idea how dire it is for retail. 300 retailers, 300 companies owning multiple stores. And this includes 23 that I think you would all know. Let me, you know, The Limited, H.H. Gregg, Payless, Gander Mountain, Radio Shack, I'm just naming a few, have filed for bankruptcy just this year, 2017. This is in an economy which is beginning to come back under Trump. I mean, this isn't, you know, in the middle of 2008. Anyway, and by the way, you can check who has filed for bankruptcy if you're interested at bankruptcydata.com. Bankruptcydata.com. anyway, kind of a scary story. Part of this is driven, and this brings us to our last segment of the show. Part of this is driven by what's happening on a much, much bigger scale, a global scale, with all the central banks. Because the central banks, having acted completely irresponsibly, having completely distorted the financial markets of the planet, having interfered in every which way, shape, and form by trillions of dollars in free markets, in the real market, which would stabilize things permanently if you allow it to, they're beginning to pull back on their policies of the last 8 years. And the world, folks, and we are part of the world, and each one of us has seen an effect of their policies. It may have been subtle, it may have been overt, depending upon the business you do, how many dollars you handle, etc. But it's there. It's there. Instead of printing money like it's going out of style, to keep interest rates low, like at 0%, think about how low your recent home mortgage is. Probably many of you have 0% car loans, all that kind of stuff. Those banks are now reversing course. They're stopping the printing or slowing the printing of money out of thin air. They're beginning to repay, or should we say, buy back these bonds. Like the Federal Reserve of the United States, and I've done shows on this, please put it in the search bar. The Federal Reserve of the United States printed about $4 trillion out of thin air, just ran the printing presses, and used that money to buy United States Treasury securities. Now, when you print money to buy your own stuff from yourself, I don't need to tell you that's not a good thing, right? I think we all know that kind of instinctively. We don't have to have economic degrees from Harvard or Yale or Berkeley to figure that out. I mean, water runs downhill. 2 + 2 = 4. Even the Wyoming hayseed can figure out that printing money to buy stuff for myself is not a good idea. But they're reversing that, which means there's going to be less money in the system. Interest rates are going to be higher, and that's going to have effects all across the board. And the beginnings of that quote-unquote monetary tightening, which, by the way, I don't think they're going to be able to affect because I think they got too screwed up. That's a whole nother. I could do a whole show on that. That monetary tightening is beginning to affect, or should we say exacerbate, the problems the retail sector, the brick-and-mortar retail sector, was having anyway because of the growth of the online retailers. Anyway, there's a lot of converging lines here. And then on top of that, you have whether or not Trump can get his agenda done with all this friggin' nonsense and obstructionism by the progressives. Because I will tell you, although I'm not sure we can, but the only hope we have to grow ourselves out of this hole, and I've talked about the whole put in unfunded liabilities in the search bar, put in national debt in the search bar. It'll give you the grim statistics. Primary debt on the planet. This will show you what a great job the central banks did, right? There was actually a guy, by the way, who I think it was a couple weeks ago. His name is Ray Dalio. He is the manager of the largest hedge fund in the world. Who, of course, has made a fortune with this zero-interest, completely false bubble that the central banks have created. He actually wrote an article, and he talked about how all this extra money kept interest rates low and drove down bond yields and created, I quote now, beautiful deleveragings, unquote. Beautiful deleveragings. Gee, I realize, you know, I just kind of load hay for Mad Max, but I ain't never seen no beautiful deleveragings. In fact, I think it's just the opposite, because global debt, Mr. Dalio, who has bilked billions out of the rest of us by using his hedge fund with zero interest rates, which has penalized everybody who's had a savings account, I might add. Because, Mr. Dalio, global debt is up. That's not deleveraging. That's further leveraging, Mr. Dalio. I don't run a hedge fund, but when your debt goes up, you're more highly leveraged. You're not deleveraged. And global debt is up by $68 trillion, that's with a T, trillion dollars, 46% increase in debt. Increase in leverage, Mr. Dalio, not decrease in leverage, from 2008. $68 trillion. And the global debt-to-GDP ratio, in other words, all the debt on the planet, this primary debt now, this is not unfunded liabilities, folks. This is not the pensions and Medicaid and Social Security and all the social support programs of the other Western nations, which are unfunded liabilities. This is just the primary debt, the national debt, plus the negatives on all the central banks' balance sheet from their printing of money out of thin air to buy their own stuff from themselves. Which, Mr. Dalio, is not deleveraging. It's a Ponzi scheme, actually. So global debt to GDP, that is primary debt of the planet, to the total gross domestic product of the planet, all the countries combined, the ratio is 276% as I speak on this radio show. That is, there is $2.76 of debt for every dollar of production. That's a really bad ratio. What's even worse, that 200, and I misspoke again, excuse me. The 276%, which was horrible, horrible, $2.76 of debt to every dollar of production, was the ratio that existed in 2007, 2008, right before the big meltdown then. The leveraging that has taken place, that $68 trillion in additional debt, has driven that ratio from 276% to 327% today. 327% today. $3.27 of debt, folks, primary debt. The unfunded liabilities of the planet would probably triple that number. Triple the number. I mean, look at the United States. We have $20 trillion in primary debt and $110 trillion in unfunded liabilities. 5-1. Just do the math. But primary debt is now $3.27 of debt to $1 of output around the planet. So, Mr. Dalio, as David Stockman so aptly points out, if there really had been a beautiful deleveraging from the insane actions of the central banks, that number, instead of being up $68 trillion, you know, that total global debt number, the number would stand at $182 trillion rather than, which is less than the 2007 global debt, rather than the $217 trillion it currently stands at. In any event, folks, I don't want to get lost in the weeds here, but I think you get the message. We're talking about tens upon tens upon tens of trillions of dollars of more debt. We're talking about a sinking GDP to debt ratio. Not a good deal. And we are talking about the ridiculous leveraging, not deleveraging, that has occurred over the last 8 years. And we've been talking about how all this ties into whether or not Trump can get these key policies done so we have at least a shot of growing our way out of this, or at least growing to the point we can stave off disaster. And one segment of our economy, the retail industry, which, along with technological change, is one of the first victims of this reversal in course of the central banks. And I'm sorry if I ended on a more complicated note for you. Suffice it to say that the financial structure of the planet and of the United States is wobbly. And it's not likely to strengthen if Trump's policies are further delayed. Not that the progressives care less about America, about you, about your pocketbook, or the economy, because the progressives are driven by one thing, folks, and that is ideology. And oh my God, I think I see Andrea Merkel. She's coming down the ranch road. Her hate speech, red lights and sirens are blaring. I think I might be extradited to Germany. Ha! Huh. But hopefully I'll talk to you next week. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. You have a great week.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.